was told that I would now have to teach a course in chemical calculations, which I had taken at Lehigh, and to the classes in analytical chemistry, and it worked out very well. Then we had chemical engineers, college students, as I said, and finally I had to stay there all the time whenever they had courses. And then I was transferred into the hygiene building, because then the student enrollment became large, and I was in the part of the building that you're in now.
And when did that take place, when you were transferred to the hygiene building? Roughly mid-30s?
Sometime in the mid-30s. And then shortly afterward, we were disowned from the hygiene building, and then they found a laboratory in the fourth floor of the anatomy chemistry building in the medical school, and we had that's when I had V12 and ASTP.
That's later on in World War II. Yeah. Yes. Did you do things like make sure that the students had the proper unknowns and,
yes,
and grading of assay values?
We assayed them, yes. We made up the unknowns and then told them, you take this and you take that, and we didn't tell them anything, and sometimes we graded them if they did not do it properly. And we had to give them exams, and everything like that had to go according to it. It was a much more extensive course in analytical chemistry then. And then these boys from the Army and the Navy, we had to follow them up. And sometimes a whole class would disappear at one time if they called them out.
Do you remember some of the experiments that you used in the 1930s in this course you're talking about, the analytical chemistry course?
Well, we analyzed radicals for the determination of metals.
Like manganese and steel?
And copper, yes.
Manganese and copper?
Yes. Uh-huh. We had arsenic, many of those, the common ordinary metals.
Yes, and volumetrically. And
volumetrically. Oh yes, yes. We had volumetric and gravimetric, and the volumetric were getting much more detailed, because we were extending them into new areas, and getting some new equipment, too.
Like what?
Well, separation. Bulbs, things of that sort.
Funnels.
Yes, things of that sort. See, Penn had had a large number of apparatus from Europe. Someone bought a lot of apparatus, and by the time some of it was to be used, it was fragile. Evidently, they had, I suspect that some of it was bought before the war, when they said that some apparatus and chemicals were brought in to Philadelphia by submarines from the European countries before we were at war with them.
This is World War One or Two?
Yeah, one.
One, yeah, okay.
And I guess then they brought some of the apparatus in too. I know that they had a lot of it stored underneath the Harrison Laboratory, and so we had the usual run of experiments. And then we usually had some of them, the better students, we would assign to some other subject, look up some experiments, and work them out.
Now, your own graduate work was with Lukens.
Yes.
On the atomic weight of mercury.
Yeah.
Do you remember anything about that, or anything noteworthy about that episode?
He assigned that subject to me. I don't know. I guess it needed revising. And, of course, it had to be the atomic weight gravimetrically. It had to be done gravimetrically so that you could calculate the atomic weight. We had to redistill. I had to redistill the mercury many times, trying to get some of the zinc, things of that sort, out of it. And it was a job.
Is that dangerous as well?
Zinc?
No, I'm talking
mercury,
about
yes.
Precautions with mercury.
Yeah, yes, but I don't know. We didn't think much of it. There was a lot of mercury around, and of course, you had these little pellets rolling around on the floor, and I guess it really was dangerous, but they didn't take it seriously.
And did you design your own apparatus?
Yes, yes, we had to design.
And make it yourself as well?
No, we took the design to the glassblower in the medical school, and then he would make it according to directions. And if you had to revise it, then you had to go back again, get some, and it had to be carefully ground and fired so that it would hold up, and all sorts of things. And then to condense it, the mercury, I would, in a portion of the tube, I would surrounded with dry ice. And at 34th and Market, there was an ice cream company. And that's where I got the dry ice, and I would fetch my dry ice there then. They didn't deliver any dry ice at that time. And so it was a chore, and very often it was a long process to get your result.
Was this done volumetrically, your determination?
No,
gravimetrically.
Yeah. And I had a special balance.
As a chloride, as mercuric,
yes,
chloride, precipitated?
Yes.
And you had a special balance, you say? Or?
Yes. The best balance that the department could buy at that time. And that's the only way I could do it. I wasn't able to get isotopes or anything like that, you know. But the results would be better with the isotopes rather than that, because it was difficult as an experiment.
Now, after you graduated, you also worked with Wallace McNabb for a while.
Yes, yes.
On some work,
yes.
Analytical work.
Yes, some analytical work.
Do you have any recollections?
He replaced. Wallace McNabb replaced the man that was in the department in analytical chemistry. And it was Dr. McNabb and I were together for a long period of time. It was the only thing that we could do. And
any recollections about Dr. McNabb as a chemist, as a co-worker?
Yes, he was a very good co-worker. In the beginning, he did the lecturing and in analytical chemistry. And then later on, when the enrollment became larger, then I took one course and he took one course. And then we would change off, too. He would lecture on a Saturday, perhaps, and I would lecture on regular day courses. And that's the way we went along. He was a wonderful person.
Where did he come from? Do you remember?
near Penn State, a small community in Penn State. He was a Gettysburg graduate and got some of his work was at Gettysburg, and then he came here and got his degree here, his final degree, I guess. Then we we took some odd jobs, like determining some metals, some copper. We had a project on oyster shells. A man, one of our graduates from the university, came in and said that he had a lot of oyster shells. He was involved in the company, and he wanted to know how much iodine was in the oyster shells as a feed for bird or for well, chickens and things of that sort. And he thought that this helped. So we had a few things like that, but you didn't have much opportunity to do extra work. You had to, most of it was teaching. And so that's what we did.
Now, in 1936, I think you were appointed assistant professor, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, I'm not sure myself.
I think I'm relatively sure it was 1936.
Yeah, right.
Who were some of your close faculty friends in those early years?
Dr. Alsenzer. Alsenzer. Dr. Connor. He was the organic. See, they brought in some new men, and some of these men came in under projects.
Yes, that was Ralph Connor.
Ralph, yes. Yes. And Dr. Wagner came in then. Wagner. Also, let's see.
In other departments?
Pardon?
In other departments besides chemistry, did you have?
Yes, Philip George was in our department at one time. Okay. Well,
that's fine.
Recall.
And also in 1935 or so, you begin to teach the history of chemistry.
Yes, 1935.
Could you tell me the story behind that?
Well,
how you got drawn into doing that job?
I did some work in the history of chemistry section, ACS, and through Miss Armstrong, she helped me too. Because she knew Dr. Smith's library, and they wrote a paper or two for different meetings, and Dr. Taggart was then teaching the history of chemistry, and he became ill, and Dr. Lukens then came to me and he said, I saw you in Dr. Smith's library a number of times, and we needed someone to teach history of chemistry. I said, well, I'll be glad to do it, but I know very little about it. And that's when I started. And I worked harder than the students did. And it was a required course. And so that gradually we increased the number, and then I assigned them subjects because I wanted them to do some library work. The names of persons, real individuals, and it was those people who then began to do some work, I forget just how it came about, but they gradually took some short subjects, and I wanted them also to learn the card catalog of the library, so that they could follow some of the things themselves. And then gradually I felt that they should know something about patents, things like that, because then I was beginning to get some engineers in the course. And so we had a good time and looking up things, and then I began to bring them to the Smith Library and show them a few of the important volumes and explain how they came into being, how what the process was which led to the evolution of some new ideas, and they liked that. And many of the older graduates then remark about the history of chemistry. Of course, then as time went on, and they introduced more courses, organic and physics, physical chemistry, and mathematics, then some of these had to drop out. They weren't required any longer.
Yes, then the history of chemistry had to drop out. I guess also during this time, well, we've mentioned this person several occasions already, but you knew Abe Armstrong from the first week you were at Penn for many, many years, and I was wondering if you just wanted to share with me your opinion of Miss Armstrong,
but
your memories of her.
A very able person.
Particularly in the early years, now, the 1930s. And,
she was very able and very helpful. And sometimes I would jot down a few books or ideas that whether she would help me get some information together. And she would, because she didn't have a full-time job until Kimia came into being, when Dr. Brown and Dr. Tenney Davis, you know, they were editors of Kimia.
Right, that's 1946.
Yeah.
Now, Miss Armstrong was originally Andrew Foss Smith's personal secretary when you came to Penn in 1927.
Yes. And then when Dr. Smith died, for a while she was not employed. And then they brought her back and to take care of the library. And it was a very small stipend, I understand. I never knew, because Mrs. Smith had subsidized it then.
Yes, I was going to ask you the question about how did the university get the
well,
Smith to agree to...
For a while, it was just locked in. And then when Mrs. Smith would come down sometimes to see Miss Armstrong in the chemistry building.
But didn't you all have to go through, didn't Miss Armstrong and someone else have to go through a process of convincing Mrs. Smith?
Oh, yeah. Oh, for that part, yes.
The collection.
Dodge, yes. Yes. They thought that the collection would be sold. And Miss Armstrong particularly, and Dr. Lukens. Dr. Lukens was very much interested in the history of chemistry, because the library was still there, and he knew Dr. Smith. They were very close, Dr. Smith and Dr. Lukens. And so it happened that Dr. Lukens talked to Mrs. Smith, and then Mr. Bell also said, he was a friend of Dr. Smith, and he did the investing for Mrs. Smith. Dr. Smith did not take any interest in money, except to buy books. And she made quite a bit of money through Mr. Bell. And it was we then who talked to her over and over again, and then she would go downtown and talk to him, and finally it was agreed that the library should come to Penn. Then we had to talk Mrs. Smith into giving some money, because she had money. He had quite an estate. See, the Smiths from York and Lancaster area had money. And we induced her to contribute to the maintenance of Miss Armstrong and to the care of books, $50,000 for one and $25,000 for another. And she wouldn't give any more, and she had a lot more. And so the net result was that Dr. David and...
Dr. David was the director of the library.
Yeah, yes. And Dr. Hirsch, Rudolf Hirsch, talked to her many times too, that this should be important for the university, and they shouldn't let it get away. And oft times, if Dr. David or Dr. Hirsch knew of some money coming or that might come in, they would use it for purchase of a book or two, and then make it a part of the library. And so then Miss Armstrong, they raised Miss Armstrong's salary then, and she took care of it until, I'm not sure of the year, but she had to retire then.
What was her educational background, Miss Armstrong?
I don't think that it was a self-education. I considered her as a very able person and very
she
sharp.
She certainly wrote some very good papers.
Yes. I thought that she was excellent. She had an excellent background, a family background, but I met her sister only, that's all. And it was wonderful the way she knew just the details, and I have no idea what she did. So that she was very able until she passed away in 62. And then they brought in a part-time librarian to take care of the Smith.
After she died?
Yes. And
now, Claude, you were curator of the Smith collection.
Yes.
For some time.
Yes, for quite some time.
Yes.
And this person, other person, would come in maybe 2 days a week, 3 days a week. And then in 1952, Dr. Price came as chairman of the department, and he wanted that office. So Dr. Price then had to wait. He came in from Notre Dame and went. Organic chemist was his field, specialty. Then they transferred the chemistry library, the Smith library, over to the top floor of the Hare building. And that was under skylights. It didn't have any air conditioning or anything. And it was there then that it remained until it was brought here.
Yes, in 1965, I think.
Yes. 65, yes. And then it was through Rudolf Hirsch, I think, that this space was reserved, and Dr. David. And then that was a hectic period. I was not here that summer. I was abroad and doing some traveling and some research. And But it survived, and I was happy that it had air conditioning and was not under the skylights, things of that sort. But then we would come over here and have part-time help. It was under lock and key most of the time. I had a key to get in, and I guess I still have one. We would bring classes over here in the history and high school groups, things of that sort.
Did you buy a lot of books for the collection yourself?
No. Rudolph did. Rudolph looked over the booklets, pamphlets, and he is the one that decided. I was happy with that, because he knew what would be suitable and whether they could afford extra expenditures for these books.
Now, could you tell me again your activities during World War II? We're about at that stage now, I think around 1940.
Well, I taught the...
you did during World War II.
I was in charge of the Navy and Army courses in analytical chemistry. That was all. That's when we were over in the medical school, the top floor. I never had Army or Navy service.
It's really beginning with World War II that you begin to publish papers in the history of chemistry as well.
The reason, I think, was that it was the Navy and the Army groups that I had. And then sometimes they would take a group away and send them abroad or whatever, or put them in a research laboratory. And then maybe I didn't have anything for a while. And that's when I was prone to induction. See, I was still of age that they could put me in some service agency, but the university kept me here. And I was thankful for that. So
that's when you started publishing a little bit in the history of chemistry.
But it was always that I was limited. I had more teaching to do than anything else. And I had when I was over in the medical school about 10 years, and also in the hygiene lab before that, I had to take care of all of the apparatus, chemicals.
Cleaning the glass, making sure the glassware was totally clean?
No, I didn't have to clean that. I made the students do that as well as they were able. I didn't have to do that part. But I had to see that the lab was cleaned up, that is, the things were in order, and if it was inspected by some authority from the university, then they would approve of it. And then I had an automobile at that time, and so I had to transfer a lot of apparatus and chemicals from chemistry over to the medical school, and I could park in the back there, and then I had to cart it to the fourth floor.
Where was your office, in the chemistry building or the med school?
In the med school at that time. Yes.
But your department was chemistry.
Yeah.
Yes, so you had a split.
Well, yes. See, we were a dual department for a while, chemistry and chemical engineering. And that's why some of the chemistry was in Towns School, and some was in the Harrison Lab, and some was, in hygiene, and then later on when we were had to get out of there, then we were over in the medical school. And I spent a lot of time putting, transporting things back and forth with my automobile.
Now, during the 30s, you had mentioned earlier that you began to get interested in the division of the history of chemistry.
Yes.
you began to get to know some of these other people who were also,
oh, yes,
who shared your interest. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to know whether what your impressions of people like Charles Brown, Tenney Davis, just your recollections of
some of those men are very able.
Like Charles Brown?
Yes. And Tenney Davis, because and Van Cluster, I believe, is one. And